To further justify this policy, Stevenson wrote an essay titled, Why I Am a Bad Correspondent. At the core of his explanation for his inaccessibility is the following decision. The productivity equation, he writes, is a non-linear one, in other words. This accounts for why I am a bad correspondent and why I very rarely accept speaking engagements. If I organize my life in such a way that I get lots of long, consecutive, uninterrupted time chunks, I can write novels. But as those chunks get separated and fragmented, my productivity as a novelist drops spectacularly. Stevenson sees two mutually exclusive options. He can write good novels at a regular rate, or he can answer a lot of individual emails and attend conferences, and, as a result, produce lower quality novels at a slower rate. He chose the former option, and this choice requires him to avoid as much as possible any source of shallow work in his professional life. This issue is so important to Stevenson that he went on to explore its implications, positive and negative, in his 2008 science fiction epic, Anathem, which considers a world where an intellectual elite live in monastic orders, isolated from the distracted masses and technology, thinking deep thoughts. In my experience, the monastic philosophy makes many knowledge workers defensive. The clarity with which its adherents identify their value to the world, I suspect, touches a raw nerve for those whose contribution to the information economy is more complex. Notice, of course, that more complex does not mean lesser. A high-level manager, for example, might play a vital role in the functioning of a billion-dollar company, even if she cannot point to something discrete, like a completed novel, and say, "This is what I produce this year." Therefore, the pool of individuals to whom the monastic philosophy applies is limited, and that's okay. If you're outside this pool, its radical simplicity shouldn't evince too much envy. On the other hand, if you're inside this pool, someone whose contribution to the world is discrete, clear, and individualized, then you should give this philosophy serious consideration, as it might be the deciding factor between an average career and one that will be remembered. The Bimodal Philosophy of Deep Work Scheduling. This book opened with a story about the revolutionary psychologist and thinker Carl Jung. In the 1920s, at the same time that Jung was attempting to break away from the strictures of his mentor Sigmund Freud, he began regular retreats to a rustic stone house he built in the woods outside the small town of Balingen. When there, Jung would lock himself every morning into a minimally appointed room to write without interruption. He would then meditate and walk in the woods to clarify his thinking in preparation for the next day's writing. These efforts, I argued, were aimed at increasing the intensity of Jung's deep work to a level that would allow him to succeed in intellectual combat with Freud and his many supporters. In recalling this story, I want to emphasize something important. Jung did not deploy a monastic approach to deep work. Donald Knuth and Neil Stevenson, our examples from earlier, attempted to completely eliminate distraction and shallowness from their professional lives. Jung, by contrast, sought this elimination only during the periods he spent at his retreat. The rest of Jung's time was spent in Zurich, where his life was anything but monastic. He ran a busy clinical practice that often had him seeing patients until late at night. He was an active participant in the Zurich coffeehouse culture, and he gave and attended many lectures in the city's respected universities. Einstein received his doctorate from one university in Zurich and later taught at another. He also, interestingly enough, knew Jung, and the two shared several dinners to discuss the key ideas of Einstein's special relativity. Jung's life in Zurich, in other words, is similar in many ways to the modern archetype of the hyper-connected digital age knowledge worker. Replace Zurich with San Francisco, and letter with tweet, and we could be discussing some hotshot tech CEO. Jung's approach is what I call the bimodal philosophy of deep work. This philosophy asks that you divide your time, dedicating some clearly defined stretches to deep pursuits and leaving the rest open to everything else. During the deep time, the bimodal worker will act monastically, seeking intense and uninterrupted concentration. During the shallow time, such focus is not prioritized. This division of time between deep and open can happen on multiple scales. For example, on the scale of a week, you might dedicate a 4-day weekend to depth and the rest to open time. Similarly, on the scale of a year, you might dedicate one season to contain most of your deep stretches, as many academics do over the summer or while on sabbatical. The bimodal philosophy believes that deep work can produce extreme productivity, but only if the subject dedicates enough time to such endeavors to reach maximum cognitive intensity, the state in which real breakthroughs occur. This is why the minimum unit of time for deep work in this philosophy tends to be at least one full day. To put aside a few hours in the morning, for example, is too short to count as a deep work stretch for an adherent of this approach. At the same time, the bimodal philosophy is typically deployed by people who cannot succeed in the absence of substantial commitments to non-deep pursuits. Jung, for example, needed his clinical practice to pay the bills and the Zurich coffee house scene to stimulate his thinking. The approach of shifting between two modes provides a way to serve both needs well. To provide a more modern example of the bimodal philosophy in action, we can once again consider Adam Grant, the Wharton Business School professor whose thoughtfulness about work habits was first introduced in Part 1. As you might recall, Grant's schedule during his rapid rise through the professorship ranks at Wharton provides a nice bimodality case study. On the scale of the academic year, he stacked his courses into one semester so that he could focus the other two on deep work. During these deep semesters, he then applied the bimodal approach on the weekly scale. He would, perhaps once or twice a month, take a period of 2 to 4 days to become completely monastic. He would shut his door, put an out-of-office autoresponder on his email, and work on his research without interruption. Outside of these deep sessions, Grant remained famously open and accessible. In some sense, he had to be. His 2013 bestseller, Give and Take, promotes the practice of giving of your time and attention without expectation of something in return as a key strategy in professional advancement. Those who deploy the bimodal philosophy of deep work admire the productivity of the monastics, but also respect the value they receive from the shallow behaviors in their working lives. Perhaps the biggest obstacle to implementing this philosophy is that even short periods of deep work require a flexibility that many fear they lack in their current positions. If even an hour away from your inbox makes you uncomfortable, then certainly the idea of disappearing for a day or more at a time will seem impossible. But I suspect bimodal working is compatible with more types of jobs than you might guess. Earlier, for example, I described a study by Harvard Business School professor Leslie Perlow. In this study, a group of management consultants were asked to disconnect for a full day each work week. The consultants were afraid the client would rebel. It turned out that the client didn't care. As Jung, Grant, and Perlow's subjects discovered, people will usually respect your right to become inaccessible if these periods are well-defined and well-advertised, and outside these stretches, you're once again easy to find. The rhythmic philosophy of deep work scheduling. In the early days of the Seinfeld show, Jerry Seinfeld remained a working comic with a busy tour schedule. It was during this period that a writer and comic named Brad Isaac, who was working open mic nights at the time, ran into Seinfeld at a club waiting to go on stage. As Isaac later explained in a now classic Lifehacker article, I saw my chance. I had to ask Seinfeld if he had any tips for a young comic. What he told me was something that would benefit me for a lifetime. Seinfeld began his advice to Isaac with some common sense, noting, the way to be a better comic was to create better jokes, and then explaining that the way to create better jokes was to write every day. Seinfeld continued by describing a specific technique he used to help maintain this discipline. He keeps a calendar on his wall. Every day that he writes jokes, he crosses out the date on the calendar with a big red X. After a few days, you'll have a chain, Seinfeld said. Just keep at it, and the chain will grow longer every day. You'll like seeing that chain, especially when you get a few weeks under your belt. Your only job next is to not break the chain. This chain method, as some now call it, soon became a hit among writers and fitness enthusiasts, communities that thrive on the ability to do hard things consistently. For our purposes, it provides a specific example of a general approach to integrating depth into your life, the rhythmic philosophy. This philosophy argues that the easiest way to consistently start deep work sessions is to transform them into a simple, regular habit. The goal, in other words, is to generate a rhythm for this work that removes the need for you to invest energy in deciding if and when you're going to go deep. The chain method is a good example of the rhythmic philosophy of deep work scheduling because it combines a simple scheduling heuristic, do the work every day, with an easy way to remind yourself to do the work, the big red X's on the calendar. Another common way to implement the rhythmic philosophy is to replace the visual aid of the chain method with a set starting time that you use every day for deep work. In much the same way that maintaining visual indicators of your work progress can reduce the barrier to entry for going deep, eliminating even the simplest scheduling decisions, such as when during the day to do the work, also reduces this barrier. Consider the example of Brian Chappelle, the busy doctoral candidate I introduced in the opening to this strategy. Chappelle adopted the rhythmic philosophy of deep work scheduling out of necessity. Around the time that he was ramping up his dissertation writing, he was offered a full-time job at a center on the campus where he was a student. Professionally, this was a good opportunity, and Chappelle was happy to accept it. But academically, a full-time job, especially when coupled with the recent arrival of Chappelle's first child, made it difficult to find the depth needed to write thesis chapters. Chappelle began by attempting a vague commitment to deep work. He made a rule that deep work needed to happen in 90-minute chunks, recognizing correctly that it takes time to ease into a state of concentration, and he decided he would try to schedule these chunks in an ad hoc manner whenever appropriate openings in his schedule arose. Not surprisingly, this strategy didn't yield much productivity. In a dissertation boot camp Chappelle had attended the year before, he'd managed to produce a full thesis chapter in a single week of rigorous deep work. After he accepted his full-time job, he managed to produce only a single additional chapter in the entire first year he was working. It was the glacial writing progress during this year that drove Chappelle to embrace the rhythmic method. He made a rule that he would wake up and start working by 5:30 every morning. He would then work until 7:30, make breakfast, and go to work already done with his dissertation obligations for the day. Pleased by early progress, he soon pushed his wake-up time to 4:45 to squeeze out even more morning depth. When I interviewed Chappelle for this book, he described his rhythmic approach to deep work scheduling as both astronomically productive and guilt-free. His routine was producing 4 to 5 pages of academic prose per day and was capable of generating drafts of thesis chapters at a rate of 1 chapter every 2 or 3 weeks, a phenomenal output for someone who also worked a 9-to-5 job. Who's to say that I can't be that prolific, he concluded. Why not me? The rhythmic philosophy provides an interesting contrast to the bimodal philosophy. It perhaps fails to achieve the most intense levels of deep thinking sought in the day-long concentration sessions favored by the bimodalist. The trade-off, however, is that this approach works better with the reality of human nature. By supporting deep work with rock-solid routines that make sure a little bit gets done on a regular basis, the rhythmic scheduler will often log a larger total number of deep hours per year. The decision between rhythmic and bimodal can come down to your self-control in such scheduling matters. If you're Carl Jung and are engaged in an intellectual dogfight with Sigmund Freud's supporters, you'll likely have no trouble recognizing the importance of finding time to focus on your ideas. On the other hand, if you're writing a dissertation with no one pressuring you to get it done, the habitual nature of the rhythmic philosophy might be necessary to maintain progress. For many, however, it's not just self-control issues that bias them toward the rhythmic philosophy, but also the reality that some jobs don't allow you to disappear for days at a time when the need to go deep arises. For a lot of bosses, the standard is that you're free to focus as hard as you want, so long as the boss's emails are still answered promptly. This is likely the biggest reason why the rhythmic philosophy is one of the most common among deep workers in standard office jobs. The journalistic philosophy of deep work scheduling. In the 1980s, the journalist Walter Isaacson was in his 30s and well along in his rapid ascent through the ranks of Time magazine. By this point, he was undoubtedly on the radar of the thinking class. Christopher Hitchens, for example, writing in the London Review of Books during this period, called him one of the best magazine journalists in America. The time was right for Isaacson to write a big, important book, a necessary step on the ladder of journalistic achievement. So Isaacson chose a complicated topic, an intertwined narrative biography of six figures who played an important role in early Cold War policy, and teamed up with a fellow young Time editor, Evan Thompson, to produce an appropriately weighty book, an 864-page epic titled The Wise Men, Six Friends and the World They Made. This book, which was published in 1986, was well received by the right people. The New York Times called it a richly textured account, while the San Francisco Chronicle exulted that the two young writers had fashioned a Cold War Plutarch. Less than a decade later, Isaacson reached the apex of his journalism career when he was appointed editor of Time, which he then followed with a second act as the CEO of a think tank and an incredibly popular biographer of figures, including Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, and Steve Jobs. What interests me about Isaacson, however, is not what he accomplished with his first book, but how he wrote it. In uncovering this story, I must draw from a fortunate personal connection. As it turns out, in the years leading up to the publication of The Wise Men, my uncle, John Paul Newport, who was also a journalist in New York at the time, shared a summer beach rental with Isaacson. To this day, my uncle remembers Isaacson's impressive work habits. "It was always amazing," he said. "He could retreat up to the bedroom for a while when the rest of us were chilling on the patio or whatever to work on his book. He'd go up for 20 minutes or an hour. We'd hear the typewriter pounding. Then he'd come down as relaxed as the rest of us. The work never seemed to faze him. He just happily went up to work when he had the spare time." Isaacson was methodic. Anytime he could find some free time, he would switch into a deep work mode and hammer away at his book. This is how, it turns out, one can write a 900-page book on the side while spending the bulk of one's day becoming one of the country's best magazine writers. I call this approach, in which you fit deep work wherever you can into your schedule, the journalist philosophy. This name is a nod to the fact that journalists like Walter Isaacson are trained to shift into a writing mode on a moment's notice, as is required by the deadline-driven nature of their profession. This approach is not for the deep work novice. As I established in the opening to this rule, the ability to rapidly switch your mind from shallow to deep mode doesn't come naturally. Without practice, such switches can seriously deplete your finite willpower reserves. This habit also requires a sense of confidence in your abilities, a conviction that what you're doing is important and will succeed. This type of conviction is typically built on a foundation of existing professional accomplishment. Isaacson, for example, likely had an easier time switching to writing mode than, say, a first-time novelist, because Isaacson had worked himself up to become a respected writer by this point. He knew he had the capacity to write an epic biography, and understood it to be a key task in his professional advancement. This confidence goes a long way in motivating hard efforts. I'm partial to the journalistic philosophy of deep work, because it's my main approach to integrating these efforts into my schedule. In other words, I'm not monastic in my deep work, though I do find myself occasionally jealous of my fellow computer scientist Donald Knuth's unapologetic disconnection. I don't deploy multi-day depth binges like the bimodalists. And though I am intrigued by the rhythmic philosophy, my schedule has a way of thwarting attempts to enforce a daily habit. Instead, in an ode to Isaacson, I face each week as it arrives and do my best to squeeze out as much depth as possible. To write this book, for example, I had to take advantage of free stretches of time wherever they popped up. If my kids were taking a good nap, I'd grab my laptop and lock myself in the home office. If my wife wanted to visit her parents in nearby Annapolis on a weekend day, I'd take advantage of the extra childcare to disappear to a quiet corner of their house to write. If a meeting at work was canceled or an afternoon left open, I might retreat to one of my favorite libraries on campus to squeeze out a few hundred more words, and so on. I should admit that I'm not pure in my application of the journalist philosophy. I don't, for example, make all my deep work decisions on a moment-to-moment basis. I instead tend to map out when I'll work deeply during each week at the beginning of the week, and then refine these decisions as needed at the beginning of each day. See rule number 3 for more details on my scheduling routines. By reducing the need to make decisions about deep work moment by moment, I can preserve more mental energy for the deep thinking itself. In the final accounting, the journalistic philosophy of deep work scheduling remains difficult to pull off. But if you're confident in the value of what you're trying to produce, and practiced in the skill of going deep, a skill we will continue to develop in the strategies that follow, it can be a surprisingly robust way to squeeze out large amounts of depth from an otherwise demanding schedule. Ritualize. An often overlooked observation about those who use their minds to create valuable things is that they're rarely haphazard in their work habits. Consider the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Robert Caro. As revealed in a 2009 magazine profile, every inch of Caro's New York office is governed by rules. Where he places his books, how he stacks his notebooks, what he puts on his wall, even what he wears to the office. Everything is specified by a routine that has varied little over Caro's long career. "I trained myself to be organized," he explained. Charles Darwin had a similarly strict structure for his working life during the period when he was perfecting On the Origin of Species. As his son Francis later remembered, he would rise promptly at 7 to take a short walk. He would then eat breakfast alone and retire to his study from 8 to 9:30. The next hour was dedicated to reading his letters from the day before, after which he would return to his study from 10:30 until noon. After this session, he would mull over challenging ideas while walking on a prescribed route that started at his greenhouse and then circled a path on his property. He would walk until satisfied with his thinking, then declare his workday done. The journalist Mason Curry, who spent half a decade cataloging the habits of famous thinkers and writers, and from whom I learned the previous two examples, summarized this tendency toward systemization as follows. There is a popular notion that artists work from inspiration, that there is some strike or bolt or bubbling up of creative mojo from who knows where. But I hope my work makes clear that waiting for inspiration to strike is a terrible, terrible plan. In fact, perhaps the single best piece of advice I can offer to anyone trying to do creative work is to ignore inspiration. In a New York Times column on the topic, David Brooks summarizes this reality more bluntly. Great creative minds think like artists, but work like accountants. This strategy suggests the following. To make the most out of your deep work sessions, build rituals of the same level of strictness and idiosyncrasy as the important thinkers mentioned previously. There's a good reason for this mimicry. Great minds like Caro and Darwin didn't deploy rituals to be weird. They did so because success in their work depended on their ability to go deep again and again. There's no way to win a Pulitzer Prize or conceive a grand theory without pushing your brain to its limit. Their rituals minimize the friction in this transition to depth, allowing them to go deep more easily and stay in the state longer. If they had instead waited for inspiration to strike before settling into serious work, their accomplishments would likely have been greatly reduced. There's no one correct deep work ritual. The right fit depends on both the person and the type of project pursued. But there are some general questions that any effective ritual must address. Where you'll work and for how long? Your ritual needs to specify a location for your deep work efforts. This location can be as simple as your normal office with the door shut and desk cleaned off. A colleague of mine likes to put a hotel-style do not disturb sign on his office door when he's tackling something difficult. If it's possible to identify a location used only for depth, for instance a conference room or quiet library, the positive effect can be even greater. If you work in an open office plan, this need to find a deep work retreat becomes particularly important. Regardless of where you work, be sure to also give yourself a specific time frame to keep the session a discrete challenge and not an open-ended slog. How you'll work once you start to work. Your ritual needs rules and processes to keep your efforts structured. For example, you might institute a ban on any internet use or maintain a metric such as words produced per 20-minute interval to keep your concentration honed. Without this structure, you'll have to mentally litigate again and again what you should and should not be doing during these sessions and keep trying to assess whether you're working sufficiently hard. These are unnecessary drains on your willpower reserves. How you'll support your work. Your ritual needs to ensure your brain gets the support it needs to keep operating at a high level of depth. For example, the ritual might specify that you start with a good cup of coffee, or make sure you have access to enough food of the right type to maintain energy, or integrate light exercise such as walking to help keep the mind clear. As Nietzsche said, it is only ideas gained from walking that have any worth. This support might also include environmental factors, such as organizing the raw materials of your work to minimize energy-dissipating friction, as we saw with Caro's example. To maximize your success, you need to support your efforts to go deep. At the same time, this support needs to be systematized so that you don't waste mental energy figuring out what you need in the moment. These questions will help you get started in crafting your deep work ritual. But keep in mind that finding a ritual that sticks might require experimentation, so be willing to work at it. I assure you that the effort's worth it. Once you've evolved something that feels right, the impact can be significant. To work deeply is a big deal and should not be an activity undertaken lightly. Surrounding such efforts with a complicated and perhaps to the outside world quite strange ritual accepts this reality. Providing your mind with the structure and commitment it needs to slip into the state of focus where you can begin to create things that matter. Make grand gestures. In the early winter of 2007, J.K. Rowling was struggling to complete The Deathly Hallows, the final book in her Harry Potter series. The pressure was intense, as this book bore the responsibility of tying together the six that preceded it in a way that would satisfy the series' hundreds of millions of fans. Rowling needed to work deeply to satisfy these demands, but she was finding unbroken concentration increasingly difficult to achieve at her home office in Edinburgh, Scotland. As I was finishing Deathly Hallows, there came a day where the window cleaner came. The kids were at home, the dogs were barking, Rowling recalled in an interview. It was too much, so J.K. Rowling decided to do something extreme to shift her mindset where it needed to be. She checked into a suite in the 5-star Balmoral Hotel, located in the heart of downtown Edinburgh. So I came to this hotel because it's a beautiful hotel, but I didn't intend to stay here, she explained. But the first day's writing went well, so I kept coming back, and I ended up finishing the last of the Harry Potter books here. In retrospect, it's not surprising that Rowling ended up staying. The setting was perfect for her project. The Balmoral, known as one of Scotland's most luxurious hotels, is a classic Victorian building, complete with ornate stonework and a tall clock tower. It's also located only a couple of blocks away from Edinburgh Castle, one of Rowling's inspirations in dreaming up Hogwarts. Rowling's decision to check into a luxurious hotel suite near Edinburgh Castle is an example of a curious but effective strategy in the world of deep work. The grand gesture. The concept is simple. By leveraging a radical change to your normal environment, coupled perhaps with a significant investment of effort or money, all dedicated towards supporting a deep work task, you increase the perceived importance of the task. This boost in importance reduces your mind's instinct to procrastinate and delivers an injection of motivation and energy. Writing a chapter of a Harry Potter novel, for example, is hard work and will require a lot of mental energy, regardless of where you do it. But when paying more than $1,000 a day to write the chapter in a suite of an old hotel down the street from a Hogwarts-style castle, mustering the energy to begin and sustain this work is easier than if you were instead in a distracting home office. When you study the habits of other well-known deep workers, the grand gesture strategy comes up often. Bill Gates, for example, was famous during his time as Microsoft CEO for taking think weeks, during which he would leave behind his normal work and family obligations to retreat to a cabin with a stack of papers and books. His goal was to think deeply, without distraction, about the big issues relevant to his company. It was during one of these weeks, for example, that he famously came to the conclusion that the internet was going to be a major force in the industry. There was nothing physically stopping Gates from thinking deeply in his office in Microsoft's Seattle headquarters, but the novelty of his week-long retreat helped him achieve the desired levels of concentration. The MIT physicist and award-winning novelist Alan Lightman also leverages grand gestures. In his case, he retreats each summer to a tiny island in Maine to think deeply and recharge. At least as of 2000, when he described this gesture in an interview, the island not only lacked internet, but didn't even have phone service. As he then justified, It's really about 2.5 months that I'll feel like I can recover some silence in my life, which is so hard to find. Not everyone has the freedom to spend 2 months in Maine, but many writers, including Dan Pink and Michael Pollan, simulate the experience year-round by building, often at significant expense and effort, writing cabins on their properties. Pollan, for his part, even wrote a book about his experience building his cabin in the woods behind his former Connecticut home. These outbuildings aren't strictly necessary for these writers, who need only a laptop and a flat surface to put it on to ply their trade. But it's not the amenities of the cabins that generate their value. It's instead the grand gesture represented in the design and building of the cabin for the sole purpose of enabling better writing. Not every grand gesture need be so permanent. After the pathologically competitive Bell Labs physicist William Shockley was scooped in the invention of the transistor, as I detail in the next strategy, two members of his team made the breakthrough at a time when Shockley was away working on another project. He locked himself in a hotel room in Chicago, where he had traveled ostensibly to attend a conference. He didn't emerge from the room until he had ironed out the details for a better design that had been rattling around in his mind. When he finally did leave the room, he airmailed his notes back to Murray Hill, New Jersey, so that a colleague could paste them into his lab notebook and sign them to timestamp the innovation. The junction form of the transistor that Shockley worked out in this burst of depth ended up earning him a share of the Nobel Prize subsequently awarded for the invention. An even more extreme example of a one-time grand gesture yielding results is a story involving Peter Shankman, an entrepreneur and social media pioneer. As a popular speaker, Shankman spends much of his time flying. He eventually realized that 30,000 feet was an ideal environment for him to focus. As he explained in a blog post, "Locked in a seat with nothing in front of me, nothing to distract me, nothing to set off my, ooh, shiny DNA, I have nothing to do but be at one with my thoughts." It was sometime after this realization that Shankman signed a book contract that gave him only 2 weeks to finish the entire manuscript. Meeting this deadline would require incredible concentration. To achieve this state, Shankman did something unconventional. He booked a round-trip business class ticket to Tokyo. He wrote during the whole flight to Japan, drank an espresso in the business class lounge once he arrived in Japan, then turned around and flew back, once again writing the whole way. Arriving back in the States only 30 hours after he first left, with a completed manuscript now in hand. The trip cost $4,000 and was worth every penny, he explained. In all of these examples, it's not just the change of environment or seeking of quiet that enables more depth. The dominant force is the psychology of committing so seriously to the task at hand. To put yourself in an exotic location to focus on a writing project, or to take a week off from work just to think, or to lock yourself in a hotel room until you complete an important invention, these gestures push your deep goal to a level of mental priority that helps unlock the needed mental resources. Sometimes, to go deep, you must first go big. Don't work alone. The relationship between deep work and collaboration is tricky. It's worth taking the time to untangle, however, because properly leveraging collaboration can increase the quality of deep work in your professional life. It's helpful to start our discussion of this topic by taking a step back to consider what at first seems to be an unresolvable conflict. In part one of this book, I criticized Facebook for the design of its new headquarters. In particular, I noted that the company's goal to create the world's largest open office space, a giant room that will reportedly hold 2,800 workers, represents an absurd attack on concentration. Both intuition and a growing body of research underscore the reality that sharing a workspace with a large number of coworkers is incredibly distracting. creating an environment that thwarts attempts to think seriously. In a 2013 article summarizing recent research on this topic, Business Week went so far as to call for an end to the tyranny of the open plan office. And yet, these open office designs are not embraced haphazardly. As Maria Konnikova reports in The New Yorker, when this concept first emerged, its goal was to facilitate communication and idea flow. This claim resonated with American businesses looking to embrace an aura of startup unconventionality. Josh Tieringel, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, for example, explained the lack of offices in Bloomberg's headquarters as follows. Open plan is pretty spectacular. It ensures that everyone is attuned to the broad mission, and it encourages curiosity between people who work in different disciplines. Jack Dorsey justified the open layout of the Square headquarters by explaining, "We encourage people to stay out in the open because we believe in serendipity and people walking by each other teaching new things." For the sake of discussion, let's call this principle that when you allow people to bump into each other, smart collaborations and new ideas emerge. The theory of serendipitous creativity. When Mark Zuckerberg decided to build the world's largest office, we can reasonably conjecture this theory helped drive his decision, just as it has driven many of the moves toward open workspaces elsewhere in Silicon Valley and beyond. Other less exalted factors like saving money and increasing supervision also play a role, but they're not as sexy and are therefore less emphasized. This decision between promoting concentration and promoting serendipity seems to indicate that deep work, an individual endeavor, is incompatible with generating creative insights, a collaborative endeavor. This conclusion, however, is flawed. It's based, I argue, on an incomplete understanding of the theory of serendipitous creativity. To support this claim, let's consider the origins of this particular understanding of what spurs breakthroughs. The theory in question has many sources, but I happen to have a personal connection to one of the more well-known. During my 7 years at MIT, I worked on the site of the Institute's famed Building 20. This structure, located at the intersection of Main and Vassar Streets in East Cambridge, and eventually demolished in 1998, was thrown together as a temporary shelter during World War II, meant to house the overflow from the school's bustling radiation laboratory. As noted by a 2012 New Yorker article, the building was initially seen as a failure. Ventilation was poor, and hallways were dim. The walls were thin, the roof leaked, and the building was broiling in the summer and freezing in the winter. When the war ended, however, the influx of scientists to Cambridge continued. MIT needed space. So instead of immediately demolishing Building 20 as they had promised local officials in exchange for lax permitting, they continued using it as an overflow space. The result was that a mismatch of different departments, from nuclear science to linguistics to electronics, shared the low-slung building alongside more esoteric tenants such as a machine shop and a piano repair facility. Because the building was cheaply constructed, these groups felt free to rearrange space as needed. Walls and floors could be shifted, and equipment bolted to the beams. In recounting the story of Gerald Zacharias's work on the first atomic clock, the aforementioned New Yorker article points to the importance of his ability to remove two floors from his Building 20 lab so he could install the three-story cylinder needed for his experimental apparatus. In MIT lore, it's generally believed that this haphazard combination of different disciplines thrown together in a large reconfigurable building led to chance encounters and a spirit of inventiveness that generated breakthroughs at a fast pace, innovating topics as diverse as Chomsky grammars, Lorin navigational radars, and video games, all within the same productive post-war decades. When the building was finally demolished to make way for the $300 million Frank Gehry designed Stata Center, where I spent my time, its loss was mourned. In tribute to the plywood palace it replaced, the interior design of the Stata Center includes boards of unfinished plywood and exposed concrete with construction markings left intact. Around the same time that Building 20 was hastily constructed, a more systematic pursuit of serendipitous creativity was underway 200 miles to the southwest in Murray Hill, New Jersey. It was here that Bell Labs director Mervyn Kelly guided the construction of a new home for the lab that would purposefully encourage interaction between its diverse mix of scientists and engineers. Kelly dismissed the standard university-style approach of housing different departments in different buildings, and instead connected the spaces into one contiguous structure joined by long hallways, some so long that when you stood at one end, it would appear to converge to a vanishing point. As Bell Labs chronicler John Gertner notes about this design, traveling the hall's length without encountering a number of acquaintances, problems, diversions, and ideas was almost impossible. A physicist on his way to lunch in the cafeteria was like a magnet rolling past iron filings. This strategy, mixed with Kelly's aggressive recruitment of some of the world's best minds, yielded some of the most concentrated innovation in the history of modern civilization. In the decades following the Second World War, the lab produced, among other achievements, the first solar cell, laser, communication satellite, cellular communication system, and fiber optic networking. At the same time, their theorists formulated both information theory and coding theory. Their astronomers won the Nobel Prize for empirically validating the Big Bang theory. And perhaps most important of all, their physicists invented the transistor. The theory of serendipitous creativity, in other words, seems well justified by the historical record. The transistor, we can argue with some confidence, probably required Bell Labs and its ability to put solid-state physicists, quantum theorists, and world-class experimentalists in one building where they could serendipitously encounter one another and learn from their varied expertise. This was an invention unlikely to come from a lone scientist thinking deeply in the academic equivalent of Carl Jung's Stone Tower. But it's here that we must embrace more nuance in understanding what really generated innovation in sites such as Building 20 and Bell Labs. To do so, let's return once again to my own experience at MIT. When I arrived as a new PhD student in the fall of 2004, I was a member of the first incoming class to be housed in the new Stata Center, which, as mentioned, replaced Building 20. Because the center was new, incoming students were given tours that touted its features. Frank Gehry, we learned, arranged the offices around common spaces and introduced open stairwells between adjacent floors, all in an effort to support the type of serendipitous encounters that had defined its predecessor. But what struck me at the time was a feature that hadn't occurred to Gehry, but had been recently added at the faculty's insistence. Special gaskets installed into the office door jambs to improve soundproofing. The professors at MIT, some of the most innovative technologists in the world, wanted nothing to do with an open office-style workspace. They instead demanded the ability to close themselves off. This combination of soundproofed offices connected to large common areas yields a hub-and-spoke architecture of innovation, in which both serendipitous encounter and isolated deep thinking are supported. It's a setup that straddles a spectrum where on one extreme we find the solo thinker, isolated from inspiration but free from distraction. And on the other extreme, we find the fully collaborative thinker in an open office, flush with inspiration, but struggling to support the deep thinking needed to build on it. If we turn our attention back to Building 20 and Bell Labs, we see that this is the architecture they deployed as well. Neither building offered anything resembling a modern open office plan. They were instead constructed using the standard layout of private offices connected to shared hallways. Their creative mojo had more to do with the fact that these offices shared a small number of long connecting spaces, forcing researchers to interact whenever they needed to travel from one location to another. These mega hallways, in other words, provided highly effective hubs. We can, therefore, still dismiss the depth-destroying open office concept without dismissing the innovation-producing theory of serendipitous creativity. The key is to maintain both in a hub-and-spoke style arrangement. Expose yourself to ideas and hubs on a regular basis, but maintain a spoke in which to work deeply on what you encounter. This division of efforts, however, is not the full story, as even when one returns to a spoke, solo work is still not necessarily the best strategy. Consider, for example, the previously mentioned invention of the point contact transistor at Bell Labs. This breakthrough was supported by a large group of researchers, all with separate specialties, who came together to form the Solid State Physics Research Group, a team dedicated to inventing a smaller and more reliable alternative to the vacuum tube. This group's collaborative conversations were necessary preconditions to the transistor, a clear example of the usefulness of hub behavior. Once the research group laid the intellectual groundwork for the component, the innovation process shifted to a spoke. What makes this particular innovation process an interesting case, however, is that even when it shifted to a spoke, it remained collaborative. It was two researchers in particular, the experimentalist Walter Bratton and the quantum theorist John Bardeen, who, over a period of 1 month in 1947, made the series of breakthroughs that led to the first working solid-state transistor. Bratton and Bardeen worked together during this period in a small lab, often side by side, pushing each other toward better and more effective designs. These efforts consisted primarily of deep work, but a type of deep work we haven't yet encountered. Bratton would concentrate intensely to engineer an experimental design that could exploit Bardeen's latest theoretical insight. Then Bardeen would concentrate intensely to make sense of what Bratton's latest experiments revealed, trying to expand his theoretical framework to match the observations. This back and forth represents a collaborative form of deep work, common in academic circles, that leverages what I call the whiteboard effect. For some types of problems, working with someone else at the proverbial shared whiteboard can push you deeper than if you were working alone. The presence of the other party waiting for your next insight, be it someone physically in the same room or collaborating with you virtually, can short-circuit the natural instinct to avoid depth. We can now step back and draw some practical conclusions about the role of collaboration in deep work. The success of Building 20 and Bell Labs indicates that isolation is not required for productive deep work. Indeed, their example indicates that for many types of work, especially when pursuing innovation, collaborative deep work can yield better results. This strategy, therefore, asks that you consider this option in contemplating how best to integrate depth into your professional life. In doing so, however, keep the following two guidelines in mind. First, distraction remains a destroyer of depth. Therefore, the hub and spoke model provides a crucial template. Separate your pursuit of serendipitous encounters from your efforts to think deeply and build on these inspirations. You should try to optimize each effort separately, as opposed to mixing them together into a sludge that impedes both goals. Second, even when you retreat to a spoke to think deeply, when it's reasonable to leverage the whiteboard effect, do so. By working side by side with someone on a problem, you can push each other toward deeper levels of depth, and therefore toward the generation of more and more valuable output as compared to working alone. When it comes to deep work, in other words, consider the use of collaboration when appropriate, as it can push your results to a new level. At the same time, Don't lionize this quest for interaction and positive randomness to the point where it crowds out the unbroken concentration ultimately required to wring something useful out of the swirl of ideas all around us. Execute like a business. The story has become lore in the world of business consulting. In the mid-1990s, Harvard Business School professor Clayton Christensen received a call from Andy Grove, the CEO and chairman of Intel. Grove had encountered Christensen's research on disruptive innovation and asked him to fly out to California to discuss the theory's implications for Intel. On arrival, Christensen walked through the basics of disruption. Entrenched companies are often unexpectedly dethroned by startups that begin with cheap offerings at the low end of the market, but then, over time, improve their cheap products just enough to begin to steal high-end market share. Grove recognized that Intel faced this threat from low-end processors produced by upstart companies like AMD and Cyrix. Fueled by his newfound understanding of disruption, Grove devised the strategy that led to the Celeron family of processors, a lower performance offering that helped Intel successfully fight off the challenges from below. There is, however, a lesser-known piece to this story. As Christensen recalls, Grove asked him during a break in this meeting, "How do I do this?" Christensen responded with a discussion of business strategy, explaining how Grove could set up a new business unit, and so on. Grove cut him off with a gruff reply. "You are such a naive academic. I asked you how to do it, and you told me what I should do. I know what I need to do. I just don't know how to do it." As Christensen later explained, this division between what and how is crucial, but is overlooked in the professional world. It's often straightforward to identify a strategy needed to achieve a goal, but what trips up companies is figuring out how to execute the strategy once identified. I came across this story in a foreword Christensen wrote for a book titled The Four Disciplines of Execution, which built on extensive consulting case studies to describe four disciplines, abbreviated 4DX, for helping companies successfully implement high-level strategies. What struck me as I read was that this gap between what and how was relevant to my personal quest to spend more time working deeply. Just as Andy Grove had identified the importance of competing in the low-end processor market, I had identified the importance of prioritizing depth. What I needed was help figuring out how to execute this strategy. Intrigued by these parallels, I set out to adapt the 4DX framework to my personal work habits and ended up surprised by how helpful they proved in driving me toward effective action on my goal of working deeply. These ideas may have been forged for the world of big business, but the underlying concepts seem to apply anywhere that something important needs to get done against a backdrop of many competing obligations and distractions. With this in mind, I've summarized in the following sections the four disciplines of the 4DX framework, and for each, I describe how I adapted it to the specific concerns of developing a deep work habit. Discipline number one, focus on the wildly important. As the authors of the four disciplines of execution explain, the more you try to do, the less you actually accomplish. They elaborate that execution should be aimed at a small number of wildly important goals. This simplicity will help focus an organization's energy to a sufficient intensity to ignite real results. For an individual focused on deep work, the implication is that you should identify a small number of ambitious outcomes to pursue with your deep work hours. The general exhortation to spend more time working deeply doesn't spark a lot of enthusiasm. To instead have a specific goal that would return tangible and substantial professional benefits will generate a steadier stream of enthusiasm. In a 2014 column titled The Art of Focus, David Brooks endorsed this approach of letting ambitious goals drive focused behavior, explaining, "If you want to win the war for attention, don't try to say no to the trivial distractions you find on the information smorgasbord. Try to say yes to the subject that arouses a terrifying longing, and let the terrifying longing crowd out everything else." For example, when I first began experimenting with 4DX, I set the specific important goal of publishing 5 high-quality peer-reviewed papers in the upcoming academic year.